The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And as we've been seeing, no sooner had the credits been threatening to roll on one disaster movie than we find ourselves cast into another kind of science fiction disaster movie. So they fronted the Sunday Times, Russians started HSE cyber attack 2 weeks ago, and I gather it is critical how long they've been in there. So if they've been in there 2 weeks, I think that's a lot of time to gather a lot of stuff. The Sunday Times saying it's going to be at least another week before the system is fully operational again. Actually, somebody who knows these things told me they're going to have to check every, possibly check every endpoint of that system. And we see that there are 85,000 computers turned off at the moment. So if you have to go checking and new passwords and everything else for 85,000 computers. And that's only the, that's not half of it. The Irish Mail, gang demanded 20 million from HSE. Ransom note says patient data hacked. HSE services aging tech made it an easy mark, they say. And a poll say 80% say no money should be paid. The Sunday Independent is dealing with housing. The other big story of the week, first time buyers to get half of new build houses, they say. So these are the measures we've all been waiting to hear, which are being brought to Cabinet on Tuesday. So up to 50% of housing estates will be reserved for first-time buyers, and then there would be obviously on top of that affordable and social housing. The Business Post, however, have another spin on the government and housing and the purchase of first-time buyers' homes from underneath their noses. And the Business Post, in fairness, has been making the running on this story for the last 2 weeks. So today, they have state invested in Cuckoo Fund that snapped up hundreds of Maynooth homes. So the Irish state invested in a so-called Cuckoo Fund that bulk bought hundreds of homes in two Maynooth housing estates. More than 225 million of government funding aimed to stimulate housing supply was ultimately used by funds to buy up houses and apartments before they could be put on the open market. So you see, there's nothing simple about these things, is there? And they also have on the front of the Business Post, by the way, that Davies is likely to fetch up to 400 million when sold. And that means, they point out, that Brian McKiernan, the former chief executive of Davy and one of the so-called Davy 16 group, who's estimated to own 13% of the firm, would get in the region of 45 to 50 million. So he doesn't care what anyone thinks about him, I'd say. And the Irish Sun on Sunday, health hackers want 16 million euros. And the Sunday World, train thugs threat to sue. So this is the infamous video from Hoth Junction. A mother of a teenager suspected of horror platform attack claims her son's privacy was breached by leaked CCTV footage, and she's considering legal action. Right, so lots to talk about today, and our panel is Ciara Phelan, who's political correspondent of the Irish Mirror, Alan Barrett, who's an economist and director of the ESRI, and Adrian Reckler is the technology editor with Independent Newspapers. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning.
Adrian, why don't we start with you as the person with the most specialism in this area. So what are your thoughts now on where we're at with this whole hacking situation right now?
Well, there's a few basic questions that we still need the answers to. For example, the papers this morning are split on exactly what the ransom demand was. The Mail on Sunday says that it could be $20 million. That's based on a website called Bleeping Computer, which claims to have seen an exchange between the hackers and Irish authorities. The Business Post says it could be as low as 120,000 euro or three Bitcoin. There are a few basic questions such as...
Yeah, but the Mail appears to have the note that came up on the screen, and we'll come back to it in a while, but it does say 19,999,000.
Yeah, we reported on that as well. The Mail, to be fair, does say that it had that confirmed by sources within the HSE that conversation was floating out there in the ether. It's from a website called Bleeping Computer. But the other claim there, that 700 gigabytes of sensitive patient data was also stolen and may be leaked as part of this attack, is also kind of very worrying. And there isn't really yet full reassurance from either the HSE or Department of Justice or the Gardaí that that data has not been stolen and that it won't be leaked. Don't forget that this particular type of ransomware attack from this gang, the Conti gang, they specialise in a sort of a double extortion. Firstly, demanding a ransom so that they'll unlock all of your data, and then secondly, demanding a second ransom so that they won't publicly leak some sensitive data that they've stolen as part of the process. So,
and I gather as well that it says on their website, if you go there to look to see if they've leaked your data, they say if your data's not up here, don't worry, we haven't forgotten about you. It just means we've sold it to a private client. So there's a third opportunity for them there as well.
Yeah. In fact, the tone of the conversations between ransomware gangs like this one and authorities can be disturbingly civil at times. There are lots of examples of what they have a proper e-commerce support operator. It's like going on a web chat with a service provider. It's very, very weird and very, very dystopian. I mean, some of the other questions that I certainly have, and I'm sure a lot of people will have, is about the IT systems themselves. A, whether they can be fully restored to being functional, how soon that will be. There's a floating estimate of about a week being posited by a lot of the papers this morning. And then there's the question of whether the IT systems in the HSE and other state agencies may be vulnerable to similar attacks. Now, I mean, we know with the HSE in particular that it has been running on quite a number of outdated computer systems, Windows 7, which is an obsolete version of Microsoft Windows. Probably about half the computers still run Windows 7. But
they were, the HSE do pay out money to those protected, don't they?
They do pay out money to have those protected to Microsoft. It's a special security license, but that is indicative of the kind of investment or where IT investment might sit in the grand scheme of things among state agencies.
Yeah. Okay. Ciara Phelan, Adrian makes an interesting point there that we don't know a lot yet. It feels like they don't know much yet, or they're not telling us much
worrying,
yet.
I think, to be honest. Yeah, I think it is. And I know we saw across the papers, I think it was in the Daily Mail this morning, we have a Justice Minister that hasn't really come out yet and spoken about it. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin's statement on Friday has been criticised after he flew back from Chequers. It was kind of low-key what he said. You know, he did say we won't pay the ransom, but where is the sense of urgency here? We've seen people from the HSE, all right, out and about. Where are the ministers? Where is the minister responsible for cybersecurity, which I learned was Eamon Ryan? You know, so we still don't know.
Well, I think in fairness, Ossian Smith from the Greens been out a lot, and he's been quite, I think he's been telling us as much as he could tell us.
Yeah, I know, but still, we still don't know if patients' files have been compromised. We don't know to the extent of what exactly the data that these hackers have, what are they going to do with it if the ransom isn't paid? You know, and the question is now is how did this really happen? I seen the Sunday Times today, they said the National Cybersecurity Centre has had no director for a year, just 24 staff with a budget of 5 million. And then by comparison, they made that the Data Protection Commission has 160 staff and a budget of 17 million. So the focus is going to shift, I think, in the next week about how this happened and how it seems so easily happened. As we learned in some of the papers in the front of the Sunday Times, looks like this has been ongoing for about 2 weeks and people weren't aware of it. Yeah. So we don't know how significant it is. We know to some degree, we know that the systems are down, people's appointments have been cancelled, cancer cares. It's kind of impacted the COVID-19 system to some extent, but we don't really know exactly. And I think that's a big question now for the government this week. What's going to happen to this information? Is it going to be sold to fraudsters? How is it going to be used if the ransom isn't paid?
Yeah, I think, Alan, it's either Warren Buffett, the Sage of Omaha, or George Soros, the Sage of Hungary. One of them said, this is the number one threat facing the world now. And it does seem as if we've been thrown into disarray by this and playing catch up here, which is understandable to some extent.
Yeah, no, I have to, obviously, I'm not an IT expert in any shape or form, but the first time this issue came across my radar was the Department of the Taoiseach for the last number of years have run an exercise where they put together a national National Risk Register. Okay, so after the financial crisis, a lot of corporate entities in particular became aware that risk is a really central part in running an organisation. And by extension, then, if you think in terms of a country, thinking in terms of, well, what are the you know, the things we need to be worried about? And then there's an exercise where you start trying to attach probabilities to might this bad thing happen, and then also the impact. And then you sort of try to develop a set of policies around that.
And of course, it's something that we have reflected a lot on since the pandemic. Isn't it that before we were focused on things that were likely to happen but had a very low impact? But in fact, exactly. We possibly need to focus on the things that are very, very unlikely to happen. Yeah. But when they do, the impact is...
They do. But in fairness, I think you're absolutely right. But I mean, as part of these exercises, things like the pandemic came up. Now, my involvement here is that often a draft of the register would be put together and a group of us would then sort of be invited along to sort of interrogate and see, could we add to the register? Or do we think certain things were being overemphasized? But in the discussions of the cyber security in particular, like, Ireland is in a very, very vulnerable position, and this is why it was high up the agenda, because of all the data centres and all the US investment we have here. There was a real sense that we were a target. So organisations like AirGrid and others are really, really on top of this. And I'd be quite surprised in a sense if the HSE weren't all over, because the IT departments and all government departments and all state agencies will tell you these sort of, you know, attacks of various natures are always there. What's a little bit surprising about this is it's crime rather than a sort of a North Korean, an agency or a state rather, who's going at this. But it is, it's been there for a while. And I think, again, when you link this with what happened in the United States during the week and the taking down of the tube or whatever, their fuel tunnel.
The colonial pipeline,
That it's just a reminder that this is really, you know, modern warfare
crime. Look, as I was saying yesterday, we've been reading now that apparently all systems like the HSE's computer systems are actually being bombarded every day with attempts at this.
That is normal. Yeah, it's normal for any kind of organisation or business to have multiple attacks, you know, on a monthly basis. Half of all Irish businesses or large organisations experience some kind of attack, a denial of service attack, some other kind of attack. That is absolutely par for the course. The key issue here and that's just been raised is crime. Why isn't this a state actor? Why is it criminals? Because it pays. And the fact of the matter is that the cyber criminals know that 1 in 4 victims that they hit with ransomware will pay. The average sum paid out, you know, can be $200,000-$300,000. And they also know, and this is a huge problem, cyber insurance companies will pay. In Ireland, there are, if you talk to any practicing IT security professional, they'll tell you that they've been involved in negotiations with cyber attackers
and
for
indeed,
paying ransom.
And indeed, we'll talk to somebody who does.
Because the insurance companies pay.
Yeah, okay. Now, let's find out about the impact this is having on the ground, because I think this is how it's affecting most people and their lives at the moment. Emily O'Connor, good morning. And you're a consultant in emergency medicine in Connolly Hospital. So I understand that you are now working on whiteboards and with paper, yes?
Yeah, so it's very laborious, time-consuming process in emergency departments and in hospitals at the moment, but we are still operating. But honestly, it was the very last thing we needed. So just to give people an idea of the impact, it does vary around the country. There is no single information system that's used in every emergency department, but we've all been affected. So from the moment a patient arrives and needs to register, they can't register electronically. We'd all have a predetermined number of major emergency registration numbers that we keep aside that we can use for patients. Then patients moving into triage, most of us do electronically supported triage. That's resorted back to manual. And then the patient clerking, the taking of histories, all that is resorted to manually being taken down. The tracking of patients around the department. And when you can imagine, even a medium-sized department like mine in Connolly, there can be 80 patients in the department at the one time. And normally we would electronically track what stage of care each of those patients was in. And that is what's now reverted onto whiteboards. And the biggest problem for all of us is our diagnostics, our laboratory systems, and particularly our diagnostics and x-ray systems. So shout out to all. I'm not working this weekend, but shout out to my colleague Siobhan Maguire and ploughing through it in Connolly this weekend, and all our nursing, NCHD, radiology lab staff who are trying to make this work this weekend.
Yeah, and like Emily, we've been talking to a lot of doctors around various hospitals this morning. They're talking about things like that. They're having patient meetings where they're trying to work from memory on case histories. And then I gather that the not being able to compare digital imaging from a few days ago or from last week with the latest and being able to send it around is catastrophic for a lot of people, yeah?
Yeah, so most of us have resorted to, we can still x-ray patients, but it's viewing the imaging. So in some places, we still have the old-fashioned ability to print plain x-rays, and they can be, that patients would be familiar with the old x-ray you could hold in your hand up to the light. Some of us can still do that, but some hospitals can no longer do that, and therefore doctors are actually having to walk down to the x-ray department to actually view the x-ray on the x-ray machines. Then some of the more complex imaging, such as CT, MRI, trying to load those up onto CD-ROMs. And then the big problem is there have been huge developments in digital, we call it the NIMIS system, our electronic x-ray system, where we all could request and view imaging on a digital system. And what was fantastic is it was in most hospitals. So let's say in Connolly, if I was referring a patient on to Beaumont, those images could be viewed by, let's say, the neurosurgical team in Beaumont. And all those systems are down at the moment. So we're having to copy images onto discs and transfer them manually onto other hospitals.
How worried are you about how this will impact on patient care? I mean, we've seen a lot of people mentioning that people will die because of this.
We are doing our very best to make sure that doesn't happen. The numbers coming into emergency departments are the same as they have been. And I know the message going out from the HSE is that emergency departments are open, and they are open. Mm-hmm. For the sickest, but we are busy and things are slower. And there are concerns that there is going to be a lot of stuff that should be happening routinely next week is not going to happen. And we are worried about the impact on emergency department systems. So there's a lot of,
Are you getting any sense from the HSE of when they feel that things might start coming back online?
No, nothing yet.
Nothing yet. Yeah.
But my feeling is it's going to take longer than probably even the estimates are at this stage. We're already making plans to go into next week. So this is very labour intensive. It's very time intensive. It's very slow. We can always step up and do stuff like this for a short period of time. But we need things to get back to normal as soon as possible.
Yeah. And in an emergency department, you're not dealing with people with history files anyway, are you? So you can work on it by just starting from scratch with everybody and writing it down. But anyone who's
That's
in the system long term is in a totally different ballgame, aren't they?
Yeah, we can still pull the charts manually.
Okay.
But there is a variation. Some places will hold a lot of patient chart details electronically, and then some places will have a lot of paper systems. So there is variation in that around the system.
Okay.
It's going to be matching up of that between the new information and the old information. What we can't understand, I'm sure, this is the last thing we needed. Why on earth someone would do this? It's just we fail to understand.
Yeah, well, I think it's the oldest reason in the world, money.
Okay,
listen, good luck over the next week
to you, Brendan.
And all your colleagues, Emily. Okay, thanks a million. That's Emily O'Connor, consultant in emergency medicine in Connolly Hospital. I suppose one thing that this does is it makes us all think a little bit more broadly, Ciara, doesn't it, about should we be more paranoid in our own lives? Because we are all very, very dependent through our devices, our phones, our homes, everything. Like, it's all there.
It is. It's heartbreaking to hear from Emily as well, and to hear that what they're going through after a year of hell with COVID, and this is the last thing that they need. But to your point, I think this will kind of get the hairs on the back of the neck standing up a little bit for people to be more conscious of their information, how they share it. Even we see with WhatsApp and other apps as well, how easily information can get out there. So
because your age group kind of came to this decision that privacy, we're not that bothered about it, like old people bang on about it, but we're happy to share all this stuff and have it there and everything. But
maybe
that's nonsense,
there's far
to be honest, but anyway.
Adrian, sorry, I
think it's nonsense. I honestly, Brendan, I think that if you look at younger people's habits versus older people's habits, younger people are the ones who use networks like Snapchat, which have auto-deleting messages. They are far more likely to be conscious of things like blocking people. They're not the ones who put their entire lives up on Facebook. And they're not the ones who click on phishing emails that let ransomware viruses into their companies either.
I think it's a certain age group that's using Snapchat now. I think I'm 28 this year, so I think that age group has definitely moved on. So a younger age group now. I see like my 13-year-old niece uses Snapchat big time. But I do disagree with you a little bit. If you look at Instagram, my generation have everything up on Instagram: what they ate for breakfast, where they are, their location, what they're wearing, who their families are, who their boyfriends are. There's no privacy whatsoever when it comes to Instagram for a lot of people, which can kind of lead to, you know, we used to talk about, you know, how years ago you were warned not to, you'd always be warned if there was a funeral, if there was a wedding, not to let, you know, everyone know locally because your house could be raided or your house could be robbed. Whereas I do think some my generation that goes out the window a little bit. But regarding Snapchat, I do think young people use it a lot more than my generation, talking about 13, 14, 15.
But I do notice with the teenagers, they all seem to know where all the other teenagers are at all times, which strikes me as kind of odd. Adrian, you mentioned there about clicking on the phishing emails. Is this a bit of a wake-up call in terms of, I feel if I owned a company now and I had a load of people working from home, I'd be like, I need to get those people back into the office and under my control and under my roof as soon as possible.
From a security perspective, you'd be absolutely dead right. So there was a doubling of ransomware and other malware viruses last year because of the pandemic, because so many people went home, they were working off, you know, old laptops, old PCs, they were logging into their office systems. Many Irish companies still do that. There was a huge security scare about 2 months ago. There was a massive exploit on that affected logging into Microsoft systems. So you'd be absolutely right. Like people at home, and particularly clicking on phishing emails. And to be fair, some of these emails they're pretty good. They're pretty sophisticated. If you're working, for example, if you're in the HSE and you get an email from that looks like it's from a colleague and it says something like, I just wanted to check this vaccination list for tomorrow. You know, you can see why
people click in.
You could, you know, you click it, and it's very, very easy.
It's so believable
to spoof an email.
Yeah, you know? Even the the Department of Social Protection, only a couple of weeks ago, had warned people about receiving phone calls from an 083 number, and it was so believable. You know, normally, if you get a spam or a phone call from a fisher, it's an odd number. But it was an 083 number and they were warning about it. So you can understand how, like, I would pick up an 083 number and obviously I would have the common sense not to give details over the phone, but some elderly mightn't.
Not to depress people even more, but this is not going to be helped by the fact that Facebook, there was a Facebook data leak with 1.3 million Irish mobile numbers against full names, location, and in many cases occupation 6 weeks ago. That's floating out there in the ether.
Look, every password I try and use now, it tells me this password has been in a data leak. You need to change it straight away. Listen, I want to go to another call now. Rona Murphy, CEO of Smart Tech 247, and has direct experience of dealing with hackers. Good morning, Ronan.
Good morning, Brendan.
Okay, Ronan, from your experience of how these interactions develop, where are we at now in terms of the government has said very publicly there will be no ransom paid, and they seem to be putting out the story that we are rebuilding the system safely, cleansing as we go or whatever, and that we have a backup. What are the hackers likely to do now?
So, it's been well documented this morning, Brendan, that this is the Conti ransomware gang who are they're a gang I've dealt with in the past in Russia. They're in St. Petersburg, and they use a double extortion method. And unfortunately for victims in that scenario, you not only have to deal with the terrible fallout and the destruction of your services, and I mean, my heart went out listening to Emily and the challenges of being on the front line and not having your systems working, but you now have the double extortion conundrum where there's the potential for this data to be leaked or to be shared on public forums. And
what do you think Conti are likely to do now if they've been told very publicly, you guys are not getting a penny out of us and we're going our own way here? What do you think so, their move now is?
I mean, these are business people. They're criminals. They're scrupulous criminals, but they're business people, and they have a reputation to uphold. And that has there's a number of factors that are important here. Number one, if you don't pay, they will dump the data. Be under no illusions there. Number two, if you do pay, they typically do decrypt your data. They give you your keys back, and they don't publish your data. They have to maintain a standard. I know this does sound bizarre, yeah. Right? Because I'm talking about, you know, really, really bad people. But they do have a reputation to uphold. So the problem that organizations find themselves in, and this is where the Colonial Pipeline guys found themselves in North America, was, do we consider a payment, which I'm not an advocate for, by the way, do we consider a payment and do we get our stuff back up and running and get our data back? Or do we not pay and rebuild our systems, deal with the headache and the inability to deliver services, and then run the gauntlet of having that data dumped on the dark web and people having access to it? I think an important consideration that has to be mulled over there is, what's the profile of the data that's been exfiltrated? I see the media saying 700 gig of personal patient data, home addresses, phone numbers, contact information, employee information, databases, bank statements, etc. So, I mean, there's
payroll as well, which suggests people's bank accounts, doesn't it?
Yeah, payroll as well. So there'll have to be a lot of thought put into that. This is high stakes poker, and it's high stakes negotiation now, you know.
Okay, so you brokered these kind of deals with hackers before. What would you be doing now if you're in the middle of this?
It's a very unusual position to find yourself in. What's now going to happen is, these guys are going to understand in extreme detail the profile and the nature of the problem that they have caused. They're going to have financial estimates on the cost of restoration, the cost of potential class action lawsuits against the health service for the data being leaked. And they'll put a price on it. It appears the price they put down is 20 million. And in my estimation, they would probably settle for 4 or 5 million based on the ability to negotiate with them. That's what you'll have seen in the Colonial Pipeline hack. They were looking for 26 million. They got 5 million.
And Ronan, the much easier thing to do here would be to give them the money right now in the short term, wouldn't it?
It certainly would be the easy way out, yeah. It's not something I condone. It's not something I would advocate for, but absolutely, it is the easiest way to end your predicament. But, you know, maybe the easiest way isn't always the right way.
Yeah. You brokered a deal just last week with hackers, did you?
I did.
Just to give us an example of how it works, tell us what happened.
So in this particular instance, it was a company in Asia. They had a large repository of their data was encrypted by a Russian ransomware gang. They contacted us to reach out to these guys. We reached out to them. We started the negotiation communication with them. They gave us a price. We told them it was too expensive, that we can't afford that, we're not going to pay it. We told them we didn't believe that they had the ability to decrypt our data. So we identified one specific asset within the environment where a decryption of that would have been helpful to the business to get that specific data back, in this instance, payroll. We negotiated payment for one key just to prove that they had the ability to decrypt, and that was successful. We then went back and we said, look, you have 400 servers. We now want to engage to do another 20 because our leadership team don't believe that you have the ability to decrypt. We made a payment for those 20, and then we just went along till we got the business to a position where they were comfortable with the assets that they were able to restore, they could function along. And we paid in batches, and it's a very uncomfortable position to be in. I want to say I don't advocate for this, but yeah. it's a very uncomfortable position because you're paying extortionists and there's no guarantee you're going to get your decryption keys. We simply facilitated the negotiation with these guys because it's a complex negotiation. There's lots of moving parts. It's very risky. In this instance, it was a very successful outcome, I would say.
that's relative, right? It was successful insofar as they got the business back up and running. It was very unsuccessful from the fact that they paid some substantial sums of money to almost a terror, you could consider it to be a terrorist organisation.
Okay, Ronan Murphy, CEO of SmartTech247, thanks very much for that, very illuminating. Adrian, it's tempting to pay them off and get rid of them and make it go away, isn't it?
It is, and quite a lot of people do that, as I said, because particularly cyber insurance companies will reimburse the victim. There are two problems with it. The first is that even if you pay them, you sometimes don't get your data, and the Colonial Pipeline example in the States last week was a pretty good example of that. They paid over $2 million to the ransomware hackers in exchange for a decryption key. The decryption key was so slow that they may as well not have had it, and they ended up having to manually restore most of their own data from their own backup. So you could argue it's wasted money. The second problem, as the HSE and the government and a lot of others have pointed out, it just funds it further ransomware crime. Yeah. If they know that after everything is said and done, you're likely to cough up, of course they're going to come back and do it again. This particular gang, the Conti gang, you know, reputed to have been behind anywhere between 50 and 150 ransomware attacks, you know, over the last 6 to 7 months. It's big money. They're making $10, $20 million off of this. The French government have a strong policy on this. They have urged insurance companies there to stop paying out, and AXA in France has gone along with that. They're saying they will no longer support ransomware payments if you get hit. So in the medium term, that might help. But if the HSE were just to pay over 20 million or 5 million or whatever, wherever it is, why wouldn't they come back and hit some of our other agencies?
Kira, from a political point of view, though, this is going to become more and more uncomfortable. It seems everyone agrees it's going to go on for more than a week.
Yeah, I think.
As there's carnage in the hospital system. I know 80% of people against paying at the moment, but people are going to start saying, well, are you fixing this? What are you doing?
And
the optics are going to be shocking, aren't they?
Optics will be shocking, but I think essentially the state can't be seen to pay international criminals. End of. They're not going to do
seen to pay.
Well, they can't. They can't either. But, I just think, and they've come out quite strong. Like, if they weren't sure about the situation, we wouldn't have had the Taoiseach come out and said, or the HSE bosses to come out and say, we're not going to pay it. And like I saw one of the reports in the Irish Independent, it would open a Pandora's box, as is what Ronan and what Adrian is saying as well. Yeah. So, no, they can't. Like, you just simply, it would be a bit bonkers to see that an Irish state would pay international criminals. And like that, it would result in funding them. So you could only imagine the headlines after that. But I do think, like you said, Brendan, people are going to ask now, how are we going to fix this? I think, truth be told, it will last for, it could go on for a long time rather than just a week.
Yeah. Last word on this, Alan.
It's an intergenerational thing, but I wonder if somebody in the Department of Justice is dusting down the files on how ransom demands were dealt with a long time ago. We haven't really dealt with these, but I think there's a bit of history that this sort of thing did come up in a slightly different guise previously.
Yeah. Simpler times. Okay, Ciara Phelan, Alan Barrett and Adrian Reckler staying with us. Let's take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Ciara Phelan, Alan Barrett and Adrian Reckler. Just before we move on from that, a couple of texts. Dara pointing out that we need to start focusing on how these viruses get in and running education ads to warn people. He finishes up saying users are the main line of defence. It's the equivalent of opening the door to a stranger. And that's it. It's your classic weak link problem, where you are only as strong as your weakest link. And massive company or massive organisation like the HSE, hard to keep all your weak links strong. I think a lot of people are starting to get annoyed now and saying, one texter saying this is a complete failure of national security. How was it hacked for 2 weeks and no one seems to know, says John in Limerick. And another texter pointing out, with all the top tech companies on this planet based on this island, you'd imagine they would help our inept government in how to secure the island internet services from ransomware and hackers. Well, look, we don't know that they're inept yet. I don't think we know enough to know where the fault lies at the moment. But look, hard as it is to believe right now, we had massive problems before the sack came along on Friday morning. And of course, we had a big problem with housing and the economy. And look, Alan, Kieran, I'm going to come to you in a minute because you're probably the person who has most to tell us about this. But Alan, the ESRI kind of put another layer onto this conversation last week with your report. And I suppose what most people took from it was that young people now, I suppose it was always the case that we all thought we would have a better life than our parents did. Young people now cannot aspire to even have the life their parents had.
Well, hopefully it's not as bad as that. But certainly what was being pointed out is that the younger generation at the moment are obviously facing a significant number of challenges. So, I mean, the first of these challenges is almost like the sort of, if you link the last recession and this recession, most generations only have to deal with one recession. OK, we normally had these things every 30 years, like the 1950s, the 1980s. So the fact that you have a relatively young cohort that's been hit dramatically in quick succession. And again, we know from lots of economic research that if you enter the labour market during a time of recession, it tends to be quite bad for you.
It's a lag for your whole life.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. The additional thing, of course, that we've now been talking about is the housing situation and the cost of housing, and clearly sort of some frightening statistics there in terms of the amount of money, the share of income that the younger sort of generation have to spend. I mean, I think the intergenerational thing is kind of interesting, though, in that I think we always have to remember that it is the case that there are more people working in Ireland than ever before, and that one of the reasons we have a housing crisis is that we have more people than ever before. We've more people working than ever before. We've also got a sort of a demographic bulge at the moment. There's more people in that age group who want to be transitioning into the position of homeowners, and they actually do have money behind them, okay, which allows them to a certain extent to start looking at the housing market. But there's just one additional point I want to add to the intergenerational thing, which I think does make this generation a little bit different. We have to remember wealth is higher in Ireland than ever it was. Okay. And the phrase the bank of mam and dad, that certainly didn't exist when I was in my 20s. But you hear this increasingly. It's clearly, it's only a group of the population. I'm not saying that everybody has wealthy parents, but there are a group of people, and a much bigger group of people, whose parents have actually accumulated a certain amount of wealth. And whereas in previous generations, that wealth tended to be only transferred at the time of death through a bequest, we increasingly see actually that some of the money that's now driving the housing market is actually parental money. That has been giving to kids.
So it's the giving while living. There's an intergenerational inequality then.
Oh, no, there is. And it's one of these, I mean, it's interesting you put it like that, because it's almost hardwiring the intergenerational inequality. And yet another sort of demographic point on this. If you go back to my, like I'm 53 now, and I was from a family of six, and that was very usual at the time. So obviously, by definition, any money that was being left, you know, was being split across a much bigger group of people. But one of the other sort of things that has happened in Ireland, obviously, family sizes are much smaller. So you've got more wealth among some people, smaller family sizes. And certainly, I mean, the one data set on this is the longitudinal study on aging, the Tilda data set that's run out of Trinity. I mean, they showed a number of years ago significant gifts while living for a group of people. So, you know, there's an awful lot sort of going on. And when you're doing these sort of intergenerational comparisons, there's an awful lot of moving parts. But I think that was just one dimension. That intergenerational transfer, I think, is just one part that probably wasn't discussed as extensively this week.
OK. Yeah, look, the text already now from Tom, the first generation to get free third level education, way more opportunities than previous ones, Kira, but they're still not succeeding? Historic low interest rates, buy where you can afford. That's from Tom. And you are taking issue as well, Kira, with David Quinn in the Sunday Times today. And I think Shane Coleman's making a kind of a similar point, which is that, well, like, we previous generations had it hard as well. And I think David Quinn making the point that people nowadays, adult, as the phrase is, the adulting happens a bit later. You get
maturity,
married later.
Everything
happens later.
Yeah, it's not by choice. I read David Quinn's piece, and for your listeners, it says young adults with housing issues need to grow up. So he said supply is a problem, but delaying maturity is what he's saying, and responsibility. So getting people get married later in life now. And yes, there is a change in attitude, I would say, over the years. Like my sister, she was married when she was 25. She bought her first house when she was 23. That has changed now. It's rare that you would hear people my age getting married at 25 years of age. But there's this kind of attitude that it's young people age 25 don't want to get married because they have more money in their pocket and they can splurge on avocado and smashed whatever you want to call it. And we've this stigma attached to us at the moment. I see you laughing there. And it's just the sense that...
Well, you see, I think some people would think, Ciara, that you're living life and experiencing it rather than shackling yourself to a mortgage, which is in a sense going, okay, I'm going to pump everything, make my life a misery now, to pump everything into having security in the future.
No, but you have to look at the other side of that, Brendan, because we're in a situation where people my age can't even afford a mortgage or a deposit. Yeah. And that message about the bank of mum and dad, I laugh when I hear about that, because my friends and my peers don't have this bank of mum and dad that they can go to and look for money to say, can you help me out with a deposit for a house?
Which I think is the point Alan's making.
Exactly. Yeah, but that's said all of the time. I think one of the politicians had referred to it a couple of years ago, if your mum and dad can help you out, which is not the reality for the majority of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this
generation... Would you like to buy a house?
I would, yeah, but I can't at the moment because I explained that, obviously, as you know yourself as a journalist, you have to be kind of on the button and let everything go with the drop of a hat, whereas I pay €825 for a room in Ranelagh and I live with three other people, so the rent...
So there's four rooms in that house?
Yeah, and we're all paying about €800 each.
Okay, no, so it's in Ranelagh, it's in a nice area.
Yeah, it is, but...
How big is the house?
Pardon?
How big is the house?
It's a 4-bed house, 2 bathrooms, kitchen and a living area. But I mean, like it's €3,200. Yeah. So you have to look at it for if a couple trying to rent that or buy it even,
and,
you know.
And you're going to come to a point in your life where you're not going to want to be renting a room, sharing with three other people as well. I presume you're coming to that point in your life, are you?
Yeah, well, maybe in 2 or 3 years' time, but I mean, I'll be 30 in like 2-3 years' time. So I suppose, no, I don't. But that's the issue. We don't have an option. So, like, for example, myself and my peers, we're living up in Dublin and we have to live up because of our job. We can't move down the country. Like, there's a housemate living with me. She's originally from Mayo. She's working up in Dublin, but she can't move home to save for a mortgage because how is she going to commute up and down from Mayo to Dublin every day? So you're caught paying this extortionate rent and not being able to move home then to save, even if you wanted to, because you need to be up in Dublin for your job.
So you're basically running to stand still all the time, just treading water. You can't get anywhere.
Yeah, and I mean, like, the median age, median wage in 2000, from statistics, in the latest statistics in 2008, was just over €36,000. So I don't, like, we have, and as the ESRI report pointed out, that there's stagnant wages right now, and that we are worse off than our parents, you know. So it's just, I just think that...
What do you think can be done?
To be honest, I think maybe the government, I know there's talk about a memo going to cabinet about, you know, stopping the cuckoo funds, but I actually think to save the government, if they're looking to get votes at the ballot box, I think they actually need to look at the rental market again completely. And instead of just the cuckoo funds, to clip the wings of the cuckoo funds looking at buying up estates, I actually think if the government want somewhat of a quick fix, they need to look at the rental market, because at the end of the day, when it does come to a general election again, it's the young people that are going to listen to the ESRI report, are going to listen to opposition who say and claim that they're going to fix the housing situation in Ireland, which is the dominant issue for people my generation. And I do think that maybe the government need to look at the rental market and see, like, can we make the whole country a rent pressure zone, you know, as well, and look at maybe stronger, to strengthen the regulation. You know, I know people that go to the RTB and they've been fantastic. I lived in Cork and they've been fantastic in a situation where our landlord was looking to up the rent in a 4% rent pressure zone by hundreds of euro, and the RTB were fantastic. But other people don't want to go through the RTB because they're afraid of the relationship it's going to cause with their landlord. Yeah. And it just results in serious issues. So, yeah, I'm I just think that the government need to kind of look now at quick fixes if they want to stay where they are for the next few years.
Yeah, and look, it's not confined to your age group. There's a text here from Pat, 45-year-old and single, no bank of mum and dad to rely on, the chances of me buying a house are remote. And it's that point where people give up on the idea of ever owning a house is the really depressing one. Adrian, it's tough, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree 100% with Ciara's point about renting and reforming that market. There's a very good piece by Nisha Dolan in the Sindo today, page 23, when she comes at it and she quotes this idea of us fetishizing property ownership. It's a point that was made in a piece in yesterday's Irish Times by Jennifer Connell as well. In this country, rental is always seen as the shabby, temporary fallback option. We never look at regularizing or stabilizing the rental market here like they do in other European cities, like they do in US cities, even US, the ultra capitalist country. Many of their big cities have very stable rental regimes. You can rent there for years, for 10, 20 years, and yes, raise a family, and yes, put down roots. For some reason in this country, we have a cultural problem with that. So I think it's a bigger issue than just dealing with the cuckoo ones. I think we actually need a change in our cultural attitude.
But Alan, I suppose the cuckoo funds originally were an attempt to bring in a more stable rental situation like that, wasn't it? And take it away from mom and pop where you could get messed around.
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of hopes. But I mean, fundamentally, all these discussions about first-time buyers, home ownership versus renters and everything like that, it's all about sort of moving the existing stock between existing players. And until we actually increase the stock of housing, the discussions around who should be prioritised over, I'm not saying they leave me cold, but it's not actually getting at the fundamental problem, which is we don't have enough houses and we need to build more. So it was in that context, you're right. I mean, I know it's coming up in the Business Post this morning, notion that some state money had gone into the cuckoo fund.
Well, I don't think it's a notion. Like, I think the government did invest in some of these funds.
Well, they did,
funds,
but I think, here's the original idea wasn't actually a bad idea, okay, in the sense that we know we need more houses to be built. Coming out of the last recession, one of the great problems was that a lot of the builders who had been around previously had gone bankrupt, and those who were still around, they were having difficulty getting access to finance. So one of the thoughts around that time was, well, if you could actually get big international developers who could sort of build housing quickly and efficiently and everything like that, that actually would be a positive. And my understanding is that while that money went in, this was money from the Strategic Investment Corporation, while the money did go in there, it was hoped that it was going to, you know, have a positive effect in terms of delivering more housing. If, as the Business Post is reporting this morning, that money just sort of seeped into the demand side rather than the supply side, then it's just adding to the difficulty. But really,
is the idea that bad of, and you know, the people have been complaining as well that the state then rents a lot of these houses, but I suppose the original idea was you have a pension fund, teachers or police in Canada or America or something, they would invest here. They wanted a clean annuity with a yield of 4 or 5% for 25 years and that state would take that lease, give them that annuity. And then was the idea not that at the end of that, like, the state would have an option to buy the house off and then refinance?
These are also, I'm guessing if you ask people like Ciara and everybody else looking for a home, all they want to do is be able to buy a home or rent an affordable home. They're not actually that concerned if it's a Canadian pension fund, whoever, who is driving this. But I think the other dimension of this is we absolutely need more state investment in housing and in social housing. I think this is just becoming clearer. I've been looking, I'm not an expert in housing, but obviously in my job I have to sort of interact with this from time to time and try and understand what's happening in the housing market. The only thing that's really clear is that, you know, we have a major problem and nobody is entirely sure what the solution to the housing crisis is. We know, for example, you hear people saying, oh, it's the planning system, it's the regulations, make building too expensive. You know, we lost all the bit. There's all these sort of, you know, and there's probably some truth in all of these. But
surely
I think
it's us, though, Alan. Surely it's the residents and citizens of neighbourhoods. In my neighbour, I live in a North Dublin neighbourhood. It's pretty nice. There are quite a few green fields. Every single time there's an application for an apartment building or a housing estate, there's uproar. Local councillors get involved. The residents themselves say, yeah, listen, we've no problem with more housing, just not here. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. And obviously there's a sort of a political interaction that famously some of the people who call for additional housing are also the ones making the complaints.
I think everyone seems to be guilty, in fairness, when they start.
But I think the broader point is when you have a market that just isn't delivering in the way you're, like, at a certain point, the only entity that can cut through the entire thing is the state.
Yeah.
Okay. And the state says, let's just go and do it.
Like, the state tried to build a children's hospital, and we saw how that ended up and had rings run around.
And you're actually,
does the state have the expertise anymore? You know, we hear about the glory days of the building of the great estates and everything. No. Would you put the state at it now?
Well, actually, Brendan, that really is a tremendously interesting point, because sometimes you hear people saying, oh, the state isn't, and it's about ideology and every, you know what I mean, that there's free market. I don't think it's ideology at all. I think it's more about the practicalities of these sort of things. And over time, there's no doubt the state, in a sense, reversed itself out of a whole load of sort of social policy areas and sort of outsourced it to various agencies. And housing, in a sense, was another one. But I think the argument is that now they have to retrieve the expertise. You know what I mean? Just you are right. I'm not sure they could necessarily do it that easily in the morning. But it's just clearly an area where there is a major, major problem. The state is the only entity that can reach. Now, other things need to happen as well. And if, you know, international funds want to come in here and build houses, that's positive as well. But I think that's really where we're at.
Okay. Just one text here. Brendan, the government seems to think that mom and dad are willing to have their adult children living rent-free with them while they save. Sorry, we've done our bit. I'll support my adult children any way I can, but do not want them and partners living with me. This problem needs fixing quickly. Ciara, in your experience, is there a lot of that going on? Because we do keep hearing about that people have moved home.
Oh, particularly due to the pandemic as well.
And with families, with their own partners and sometimes with small children.
I'm actually not aware of it with partners moving in. You'd normally hear of that typically if someone was actually trying to save for a house and they decide to move in for maybe a year, a partner move in with an in-law or their parents. But I haven't heard of that happening throughout the pandemic, but I know the majority of my friends have moved back with their families.
Really?
Absolutely. Okay. Well, because if they are working in office spaces in Dublin, they're closed and they're not going to pay extortionate rent, so they move back home. But then they get comfortable there as well.
Ciara, I have a whole load of boomers here know what's good for you anyway. Why does Ciara want to buy a house so young when we can travel again, leave Ireland, see the world? I bought a house at 38, zero regrets, rented for years both here and abroad, still managed to save. To be honest, as I got older, I got paid more, so it was possible.
I'd love to know his pay package.
To be honest, why are we obsessed with owning our home? Renting on Europe and elsewhere is the norm, but with good laws for tenants. And maybe that's what didn't come in with all these funds either, Alan.
Yeah, I do think as well we have an obsession with home ownership in Ireland.
Yeah, have we fetishised it like Misha Dolan says?
Yeah, I do think so. We do have an obsession with it. But I can't blame people because the rent market and, you know, landlords are dealing with difficult tenants. Tenants are dealing with difficult landlords. So that's why people are so terrified of the system themselves, because they feel that they could be shelved out at any point. Their rent goes up every year by the 4%, and they just feel they don't have security, or they may not be looked after if they go to report something. So, yeah, I think that's why we've such an obsession with home ownership. I think it dates back maybe to land and the famine and
fact that people most people in the private sector, Alan, don't have a pension.
It's another dimension of this intergenerational economic, but it's another form of insecurity. Okay, so it seems to be the case, and my God, Ciara, talking to you
is that the word insecurity? Is that the word for how we live now? Yeah,
yeah. I think people are afraid that they don't have the security.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you see, there's job insecurity, and then there is rental insecurity, both in terms of actually continue tenure, and also the fact that, well, okay, we have rent pressure zone out, so it's a little bit more controlled. But again, it's yet another interesting dimension to this, that for a lot of people, how you feel economically at a point in time is not actually how much money you're earning at that point of time. It's how confident are you that you will continue earning that, or indeed that your wage is going to grow.
Yeah.
And if you go back, you know, early stages certain of my life, you got a job and you had an expectation that your wage was going to grow. But now there's much more sort of moving between jobs. And we shouldn't be whining.
Sure, isn't that why so many people work in Dublin? Or a lot of this debate is around the urban housing markets because of the, for example, the big tech giants. Google employs 8,000, Facebook employs 5,000, Microsoft, Apple, all the rest of it. I spoke to the work from home thing might have some impact on that. I spoke to an estate agent recently who sold a house in Waterford to a young woman who had been working for the job site Indeed in Dublin, and that company said that all of its workers could from now on permanently work from home if they wanted. She was renting in Ranelagh for about 1,800 a month. Instead, she went home, lived with her parents for about 6 months, got a deposit together, and now lives in Waterford, still working for that company in Dublin. But surely,
yeah, so was it Charlie McCreevy's ill-fated decentralisation? It could just happen organically in the private sector. Adrian, is the gig economy an issue here as well? I think a key word Alan used there, and I could see Ciara ears pricked up. That generation, there's terrible insecurity, and you can take insecurity on one part of your portfolio of risk, if you will, if you feel you have a bit of certainty or a rock to cling to in another area. But they don't have it career-wise, and then obviously not housing-wise either.
I think there's two ways of looking at that. First of all, you can just look at the figures. Unemployment rates, for example, we've looked at, you know, this year versus 10 years ago, 20 years ago. In general, over the last 7-8 years, Ireland has done reasonably well in terms of employment. And the only reason I mention that is that if you work, and I'll just go back to the tech sector, which is a sector I know, and it's a huge professional sector in Dublin. If you work in Google, you're one of those 8,000 people. First of all, you're unlikely to lose your job, to be laid off. But if you leave that company, typically you'll be offered a job in 2, 3, 4 weeks. You'll be offered multiple jobs probably. So although there is a hint of the gig economy, and particularly contractors, because half of Google's employees in Dublin are actually contractors, the market is so buoyant and so strong that there is an expectation, rightly or wrongly, among people who work in that industry that they will quite easily go into another job. I mean, that's one of the reasons why so many of them walk out on points of principle over ethical and moral issues, because they know that it's quite easy for them to get a job. But I mean, I take your point. It's not like the older days, you know, with, you know, guaranteed 20, 30 years careers. But then again, the market's a lot better these days.
Okay, listen, we're going to have to leave it there, guys. That was great. Thank you very much, Ciara Phelan, political correspondent with the Irish Mirror, Alan Barrett, economist with the and director of the ESRI, and Adrian Reckler, technology editor with Independent Newspapers. We'll take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.